All news out of Africa is bad.
Paul Theroux, reading from his travel book Dark Star Safari. It's an account of his recent trip back to Africa, where Theroux taught and lived throughout much of the 1960s.
It made me want to go there, though not for the horror, the hot spots, the massacre and earthquake stories you read in the newspaper. I wanted the pleasure of being in Africa again. Feeling that there was more to Africa than misery and terror, I aimed to reinsert myself in the bundu, as we used to call the bush. There I had lived and worked happily, almost 40 years ago in the heart of the greenest continent. To skip ahead, I'm writing this a year later, just back from Africa, having taken my long safari. I was mistaken in so much, delayed, shot at, howled at, and robbed. No massacres and earthquakes, but terrific heat, and the roads were terrible, the trains were derelict. Africa is materially more decrepit than it was when I first knew it, hungrier, poorer, less educated, more pessimistic, more corrupt, and you can't tell the politicians from the witch doctors. Not that Africa is one place. It is an assortment of motley republics and seedy chieftains. I got sick, I got stranded, but I was never bored. In fact, my trip was a delight and a revelation. Such a paragraph needs some explanation. At least a book. This book, perhaps.
It says, if you'll forgive me, something about you as well. The sentence, or a pair of sentences at the beginning, all news out of Africa is bad. It made me want to go there. Most people would say, all news out of Africa is bad. I don't want to go anywhere near the place.
That's if you don't know anything about news gathering. But in fact, news gatherers look for trouble. They look for trouble much more than travel writers do. Editors kind of feed on witch doctor stories and serious massacres and earthquakes and coups d'etats and so forth. And if you know Africa, or if you know any country in the world, you realize that that's just the editors sending them there. I wasn't looking for that. I was looking for the pleasure of being in Africa again. When I was there, I was very, very happy. A lot of my trip was memory lane. It was just going back to
40 years. And...
yeah, 40 years. And also, think about it, 40 years of Peace Corps volunteers going to the same place, 40 years of Oxfam, 40 years of Save the Children, 40 years of USAID, 40 years of famine relief, 40 years of people saying, you know, we're going to whip this place into shape. So I'm old enough now, you know, I wanted to turn 60 and say, okay, all right, you've had your 40 years. What happened?
Did you go then with hope to find some positive effects? I mean, we all went into the idea of the Peace Corps, the USAID, with positive thoughts.
Definitely. You don't go in thinking, oh, it's all going to go to hell in a handbasket. You go in thinking, as I did, our days will be numbered here. I'll be here. I'm at a teacher training college. We're going to have teachers, and we're going to, you know, in 5 or 10 years, there'll be enough. We'll be producing enough teachers for the whole country, and theoretically, that should work. But I got to the place. This is after quite a lot of trouble. You know, going through Egypt, going through the Sudan, through Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, across Lake Victoria, through Tanzania and Zambia, finally all through the whole length of Malawi to my old school. That was a kind of reality check, too, of seeing what the rest of Africa had become. But then I got there, and I was told, Africans say, there's no money in teaching. Well, really? Everyone knows that. I said, yeah, that's right, there's no money in teaching, but I thought you wanted to be a teacher. I thought you wanted to improve the country. And they say, no, I really like to go to America and, you know, drive a taxi or do something. I want to make some money. In the whole north of Malawi, there's one doctor, happens to be an Irish man, and his wife's a nurse. And I said to the woman, they're from Northern Ireland, I said, what is the story here? And she said, my husband is the only doctor here, I'm the only nurse. Of course, the country is full of AIDS. And I said, why isn't there an African doctor there? And she said, oh, they'd never come here. And I said, why not? She said, well, they want more money. And I said, well, how much do you make? And she said, oh, they'd never work for what we earn. And I said, then why are you here? Why don't you just say, look, if you're not willing to work for what I'm making, maybe I should just go home and grow geraniums. I said, what's going to happen when your husband? She said her husband was in his late 60s. He was going to leave. I said, what's going to happen? She said, I really don't know. Poor things. Maybe there won't be a doctor here. Well, you know, that's a weird say. That's very strange. That's worth writing about. So I thought I was going to Africa to get away from home, have fun, you know, see old African friends. And I realize I'm writing about aid and serious stuff. I wasn't looking for serious stuff, but this is serious stuff.
That story you told is a capsule version of most of the adventures you encountered. In fact, calling them adventures is making them sound more romantic than most of them were. But to stick for a moment to your return to the place where you taught, it's even surprising that you can talk about it without great bitterness, because when you went there, you found that the school in which you had invested so much energy and which held so much promise didn't even exist anymore.
Yeah, the school was, we had a great library there. I mean, there were thousands of books in the library. And I said, what happened to the books? They said, oh, that's a story. The students stole them. I said, really? Why? And, well, they sell them at the market. And she said, you know, we really need books. Could you send us some books? And I said, you know, I'm willing to do a few things for this school, but the one thing I'm not going to do is send you books. And I'm going to discourage anyone from sending you books unless you can discourage students from stealing them. What is the point? This is actually, the woman I was talking to was very nice. She was a Scottish volunteer. Just reminded me of myself there. Pale, earnest, hardworking, overworked. And not, she's actually now, she left the school. She wrote me a letter. She said, you made me famous in your book. I'm now on the Falkland Islands. But she said, we don't have any lights in the library either. And I said, what is this story? Get the ministry to send you some. And she said, well, they don't have a lot of money. I discovered later that the Minister of Education had stolen all the money. This is in Malawi. He had stolen the money. Now, here's an interesting thing. The money had been given to them by the government of Denmark. And Denmark then said, since you stole all the money, we're not going to give you any more money. We're not going to give you money until you account for all the money that's been stolen, and you can promise us that if we give you more money, that it won't be stolen. And the Malawians got very, very angry with Denmark for cutting off the aid.
But again, this is a kind of capsule story. Where was it? In the Sudan, or was it in Egypt? You met the priest Benito Cruciani?
Yeah, no, I met him in Aswan. Benito Cruciani, who was from, he had been working in the Sudan. I did go to the Sudan and met a lot of very nice people there, but yeah. Cruciani, yes.
He was the one who said, wonderful people, terrible government, the African story.
Yeah, that's right. talking about the Sudan.
You talk about Europeans and Americans that you run across in various places. There is still in Africa an effort being made by representatives of the West to do things. But your tales of aid workers don't make them sound like people that I'd want to know.
Mine's anecdotal. My evidence is anecdotal, although I must say that you can verify any aid program by its success. I mean, the infant mortality rate in Malawi is the highest in the world. It has always been the highest, and it isn't improving. We know about aid statistics. Famine relief is something that is a necessity. If people are starving, you give them food. My feeling about a lot of people who go to Africa, including myself, is that there's a sense of mythomania. You can go there and be Ernest Hemingway. You can be Mother Teresa. You can be Albert Schweitzer. You can be just, you know, a hunter. You can take pictures. You can be the wandering, dusty, crazy, gypsy-like person getting on old buses. And so a lot of books are like that. Here I am doing this. Here I am doing that. Aid people, the ones that I met, seemed like people on a power trip. They always had the best clothes, the best vehicle, the most helpers. They pull teachers out of the school system and pay them a lot of money, and they get them to drive vehicles, that Africans who speak English well and who can do something. So there they are, going down the road, music playing on their CD, the best, you know, a $50,000 Land Rover. I don't see the heroism in that. All I see is here are these people, they're characters in a novel. They're doing their thing, and they're not even there for the long term. They do it, and then they come home. A lot of people just sort of part-time doing it.
You're suggesting really even that they do some bad. They take the teachers away from the school in order to pay them well to drive a truck, which means that person benefits, but they deprive the benefit of their expertise to people who might be able to use it.
Yeah, there's that, and there's no reciprocation. I mean, if I were running the Peace Corps, I would say, yeah, we'll send 50 teachers to your schools, and you provide 50 teachers, the same thing. We'll give you 50 volunteers, you give 50 volunteers. Expecting people to do the same thing isn't bad. We know that teachers' salaries are low worldwide. They're proportionally as low here as they are anywhere else. And I think it's fair enough to expect Africans or anyone else to do the same thing. But aid, you see, is predicated on making your own constituents rich. No one builds a road in Africa by using African bulldozers and African labor and African, you know, whatever it is, asphalt. That's Bechtel or Halliburton or something like that. It's someone in the States enriching a constituent, saying, well, we'll send you the stuff and we'll build your road for you. And so, in fact, aid works that way. It doesn't use local labor. It doesn't enrich people locally as a general rule. It's just a boondoggle. It's a self-perpetuating thing. If in 40 years it hasn't happened, chances are it ain't going to happen. So why not try something else?
You talk about Africa as a whole, as though in each of the places you went, the problems were the same. Africa is a huge continent. Is it really the same from one end to the other?
No, it's not. And it's wrong of me to represent it as a single place. South Africa is a place with a tremendous infrastructure. I mean, they have roads, telephones. They have everything that's lacking in a place like Rwanda or Burundi. So there's various levels of development. Sub-Saharan Africa has a lot of problems in common. West Africa is nightmarish. I mean, I wouldn't even contemplate a trip through West Africa. It's a truly dangerous place, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Nigeria now. But a lot of East Africa shares the same problems. A lot of Central Africa, that would be Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Malawi, share problems. But it's true what you've said, that they are distinctly different places with different cultures, different languages in many cases, and badly governed in various degrees.
That's travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux. His book about Africa is called Dark Star Safari, Overland from Cairo to Cape Town.